It's All About Food with Karen Hartglass, Wednesdays at 3 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Hi, I'm Karen Hartglass, your host today, and this is It's All About Food. It's All About Food. Thanks for joining me. And if you're hungry and if you need something to eat, your mouth is really going to water today because we're going to be talking about lots of wonderful, delicious recipes for plant-based food. Fruits, vegetables, whole grains, legumes, nuts and seeds. There's a tremendous variety of those things out there, and that's what we all need to be eating for our health, for the planet, for all life on Earth. And what I like to do on this show is show how easy and delicious eating a plant-based diet can be. So today we have a great guest. I'm really excited to have her here today. Terry Hope Romero. She's the co-author of best-selling books Veganomicon, Vegan Cupcakes Take Over the World, and Vegan Cookies Invade Your Cookie Jar. Don't you love those titles?
Yay! I do.
And she's got a new book, Viva Vegan. Or maybe it's Viva Vegan.
No, I you could say it either way, I guess.
Olé. And it's just come out. And she contributes to Veg News' Hot Urban Eats column and has hosted the public access podcast vegan cooking show, The Post-Punk Kitchen. And I just lost my page. Here we go. As co-author of the phenomenally successful cookbooks Veganomicon and Vegan Cupcakes Take Over the World, Terry Hope Romero has long been one of the most popular vegan chefs around. And this is her first solo cookbook that we're going to be talking about today, where she opens the world of Latin flavor to vegans and foodies alike. Viva Vegan expands the palates of anyone looking for a way to add fresh, seasonal ingredients and authentic spice to their meals without relying on animal products. A proud Venezuelan-American, Romero's enthusiasm for her culture shines through every recipe. This book, Viva Vegan, Viva Vegan.
I have to say it a different way now.
Yeah, I don't know. Covers every aspect of Latin cooking across the Americas, refreshing bebidas.
Yes. Very nice.
Vibrant ensaladas, hearty empanadas, nourishing stews, and one-dish wonders. Learn the basics, how to make the perfect tamale, salsa to complement any dish, and beans from scratch, plus special treats like flan, churros, and more. Okay, let's jump in.
All right. Excited?
Yes, welcome.
All right, totally excited.
Okay. We need this book.
Oh, yes.
I'm looking at it. It's another beautiful book. I go nuts over some cookbooks, and this is one that I know that I'm going nutty about because I always think that I know everything there is to know about vegan cooking, and then I learn something.
Can I say that Karen's copy has, like, all these amazing little, like, pieces of paper and stickies and pages, like, tabbed?
Right.
Like, I always love it when I see people's books like that where they, you know, have really kind of gotten into there and they've marked off where they want to go.
Now, I've made a number of these recipes in my head.
Okay.
And so I know I'm going to go back there, but I have made one for real so far because I just got this book last week.
Okay.
And that's the cachapas.
You make cachapas?
The corn pancakes.
Oh.
Oh, wow. They were really fabulous.
Oh, I'm so excited you made those.
Yeah.
Great.
Well,
yeah.
I'm a big pancake waffle-y kind of person.
Okay, yeah.
And my partner, Gary, he loves pancakes and corn and I just had all the ingredients and went for it.
Yeah, yeah.
I didn't have all the ingredients first, but I had to, you know, get a few things. Certainly
the mozzarella
was a little challenging.
Right.
But I didn't put as much sugar in as you said because I wanted them to be more savory.
Sure. Yeah.
And I also have a an issue with myself where it's hard for me to follow every recipe exactly.
Yes. Yeah, I don't know if I ever make anything completely. Even when I write the recipe the second time around, I'm usually like, oh.
I was amazed because this recipe is mostly corn kernels.
Yes, yeah.
And not a whole lot of flour.
Yeah, definitely. I'm really happy you made that one. That's a very traditional Venezuelan recipe. Out of all, because there's a lot of different ethnic, mm-hmm. a lot of different Latin and South American and different countries. And, I put Venezuelan stuff in there and a lot of things that aren't, I feel like most people are familiar with Mexican food. And I really wanted to bring other Latin, varieties of food in there. And I'm so excited you made that. And the cachapa is particularly a favorite one from my childhood, where, it's like a fresh corn pancake.
It's very comforting.
It is. It really is something. Yeah.
Now, we don't use a lot of vegan cheese. I didn't put any vegan cheese on it. We use the new Daya.
Oh.
Or Daya.
Oh.
Do you know how that's pronounced?
Daya? People say both.
Yeah. Well, it's good. But we're out of it. And
okay.
So I just made it plain, and it was really,
great. It's really great with like a white vegan cheese. Because traditionally in Venezuela, the cachapas are always served with some kind of soft white cheese. So, I found that I'm not a huge, huge fan of most vegan cheeses, but I
mm-hmm.
found in this...
Yeah, most of them are disgusting.
Most of them are bad, even though last night I had a sneak preview to something really amazing that I hope someday will come here. But but with Latin American cooking, it's sometimes like there's just... White cheeses are really like a big part, so that's where I kind of allowed a little leeway with, using your favorite kind of vegan mozzarella type cheese. And I think it works well.
Okay, so... I just jumped into this because I'm so excited about this food, but I wanted to remind the listeners this is a live calling show, and if your mouth is watering and you have a particular question, you can call in to 1-888-874-4888, 1-888-874-4888, or send an email right now or anytime during the week at info@realmeals.org. Very good. Well, it's funny that I just, thumbed through, and that was the first thing that I saw.
Oh, okay.
And it was, bugging me for a week or so. Mm-hmm. I have to make this recipe.
Cool.
All right. Now let's go back to the beginning of the book.
Sure.
So, we're all pretty much familiar with the Mexican burrito.
Yes.
And there's certainly plenty of Mexican restaurants, I think, all around the United States now with... guacamole and refried beans, mm-hmm. and you always have the tacos, the enchiladas, and the burritos. Okay, so
yeah.
I think America's pretty well, the United States of America, is pretty well versed with those foods. But just thumbing through this book, the variety just explodes with things that you can do, and there's some foods that I'm not that familiar with, and very, very exciting.
Yeah, I really, like I said before, I wanted to kind of step away from, I feel like, especially, vegans and vegetarians probably eat too many burritos. It's such a tempting thing. I did end up putting, a burrito guide in there, how to roll
easy,
a burrito.
It's easy, it's healthy, it's satisfying.
Sure, yeah, definitely. But I
And it's portable, too.
It can be, but I think, hey, why not have an empanada
right.
if you want something portable?
Mm.
It's a little more work, but, I love them. And tamales, too, actually, were, in, ancient times, those were kind of considered a portable food, by ancient Central Americans.
Okay, so one thing I like about this book is it's very friendly. You put a very personal touch to it, and you make it inviting. It's not going to be a scary thing. You explain everything, and it's like you're talking to us. And in the introduction, you write, imagine a world without tomatoes, potatoes, corn, beans, pumpkin, chili peppers, or even chocolate. Who would want to live there? Now, imagine a life without cow tripe.
Yeah. Yeah, that's kind of, I think, sums up how I feel about turning Latin American food, which people often have these ideas it's intensely meaty, which, some of it is, into something that's not, doesn't have any meat or any other animal products in it, Think about the things you really love to eat. Everyone loves, chili peppers, corn, pumpkin.
No,
I mean...
It's really a good point that you made, because so many people that are not familiar with a vegetarian diet, and there are less and less of them, fortunately, as time goes on, but still so many people, they have that deer in headlights look, what can I possibly make? And, you put it right there. Most of the food that we use to flavor things, whatever, it's the vegetables and the spices mm-hmm. and the herbs, and we can really live without the simple, boring flesh.
Yeah.
Part of it.
Yeah, absolutely. And many are very interchangeable as well. You know, you can kind of put beans in one thing, or you can put tempeh in another thing, depending on what you're feeling like.
Okay, so you write in here that you used to work for Bashuai.
Bashuai, yes.
And I didn't know that. I fell in love with that restaurant towards the end of its existence and was so sad that it went
out. Feels like a long time ago.
That was a long time ago. So, yeah. Anyway, here's a happy memory to Bashuai.
Yay.
And that's a restaurant in Manhattan that was lovely. Then you talk a little bit about green plantains.
Yes.
And can we just talk about them for a while?
Why not?
I see them more and more in the supermarkets, but I think many people who aren't used to them culturally just ignore them. Mm-hmm. And they're such a wonderful food and so versatile.
And cheap here.
And cheap.
Yeah.
So let's talk about all the things that can be done with plantains.
Absolutely. I have a lot of testers test our books, like the ones I know with Issa and this one. And a lot of times it was the first time they've actually used a plantain. And plantains are just form like a huge basis of the diet of so many people in the Americas, you know, in Central and South America. It's sort of used as like a starchy vegetable, like a potato, you know, like where it can be boiled and mashed, or it can be fried, or it can be roasted. You can really do anything with it. And if you let it kind of turn into a yellow plantain and then a nice black plantain, it gets very sweet. And it forms another, like, kind of sort of a, like a starchy vegetable that can sometimes alternate as dessert as well. So, I mean, so many things are made out of plantains.
So the yellow or black ones, are those considered ripe, and do you need to cook them?
You still need to cook them. Okay. You always need to cook a plantain. And they are just considered ripe. But it's funny, though, I think in a lot of Latin American cultures, like, you know, something's really ripe when it's really ripe. like a banana, like a lot of times, like, people will eat bananas here when they're still kind of like kind of almost on the green side. But no, people really,
I don't
let
enforce
them get really
that, and
ripe.
I don't know who started it. It has to do with agribusiness, just like picking things when they're not ripe and then putting them in the stores, and then kids grow up on that and think that's the way they're supposed to be eaten, but they're not. Bananas are supposed to be golden brown.
Yeah.
Golden with specks of brown.
Yeah. And the one thing I talk about with plantains is you buy a green plantain, you know, you're kind of in no rush sometimes. You can wait like 3 weeks. And, you know, and as it kind of changes, it transforms into like different flavors and aromas and different textures. And
so does it get
really
sweeter as it gets yellow and black?
It gets sweeter and softer. You know, to the point where, like, you know, like your basic fried plantain, if you were to get served like a green fried plantain versus a, you know, a sweet one, you know, a sweet ripe one, you might think you're eating something completely different. Mm-hmm. You know, like the green one, it has a starchy, mild taste to it, a little bit of nuttiness, kind of, you know, potatoey. And the green one is like, I mean, the ripe one is very soft. It's like super soft, very sweet, very intense, very like a caramel almost flavor.
Yeah. Well, I was introduced to the plantain when I lived in California. I'm a New Yorker, but I was in California from the early 80s to the early 90s. And that's where I discovered avocados.
Oh, yeah.
Because they grow there.
Yeah.
And they really hadn't hit the New York market. Huh. They were in the early 80s.
Okay.
Maybe they were just starting to dribble in. And there was a restaurant chain called The Good Earth. They now have Good Earth Tea.
Okay.
I don't know if you're familiar. It's a it is caffeinated, and it has a cinnamon oil in it in a yellow box.
Okay. Yes.
They branded their tea, but they used to be a restaurant. It was kind of considered a healthy restaurant where they had some vegetarian food. And one of my favorite dishes was this black bean with Guatemalan rice.
Mm.
I'm just thinking about it. I haven't thought about it in years.
Okay.
And plantains.
Cool.
It was phenomenal.
Yeah.
That was my first exposure, and I have to confess that I really don't buy them, and I will from today on.
Now you must buy them, everyone. Yeah, I mean, they're so cheap, too. Where I go shopping in Jackson Heights and Queens a lot of times, I found, like, in some supermarkets, 15 for a dollar, people. Don't waste any time. And like I said, you could actually probably buy all 15, and if you're really dedicated, you can be eating plantains for, like, the next 3 weeks. And
it's
have
like when you buy potatoes or onions. They just kind of hang on for a while.
Yeah, and even longer, I think, with a plantain, you know? Definitely
so
very versatile.
This is the ode to the plantain. So what are some of the... One of the plantain recipes I noticed in here, and then maybe we'll talk about some others, is where it's sort of like a sandwich. a mini sandwich?
Oh, the patacones, yes. Yeah, that's kind of a Venezuelan, a more recent Venezuelan thing. Like, I've been asking my dad about that, and he's like, I don't remember those. But then we had to call up some other relatives and ask them. But yeah, it's sort of like a sandwich. Like, the ones in the book are very small, but like the ones that are kind of getting very popular are apparently in the Maracaibo area. They take a whole big plantain and they smash it till it's kind of like a flat thing, and they make a sandwich with two of them, and they fill it with anything. You know, all kinds of things, you know, usually very meaty things. But, you know, I make, you know, alternatives in here to fill with a little bit of seitan and a little bit of, you know, sauce and
avocado. I love it. When I was young, my mom used to make sandwiches with a banana.
Oh.
We'd put peanut butter in the middle of it.
Okay.
And, you know, I do that occasionally because it's fun.
Yeah.
But I think a plantain is a little, what's the word I'm looking for? Sturdier.
Yes.
And
especially a green one.
And I'm always looking for portable foods that don't use bread.
Huh, okay.
And so I was just, this is a good one.
That one, it might be kind of messy. I don't know how portable.
Okay.
You know, a lot of the stuff, it's funny.
It's smashed and it gets gooey.
There's stuff coming out of it, there's sauces, I mean, it's part of the fun, and I feel like I do have quite a few sandwich recipes in there, and they're all pretty messy, but they're all worth it, you know, they're all very much like, ooh, you know, hearty, satisfying.
Okay, and any other plantain recipes in here worth mentioning in this moment?
An easy one, and this is like a way that usually my dad would make a lot of plantains, is just to roast it in the oven, a ripe one. You just, when they're soft and, you know, have that yellowish black, you know, appearance, you can just peel it, slice it in half, maybe brush it with a little oil or maybe not, put a little bit of brown sugar on it, or in Venezuela or in other Latin American countries, they use papelón. I call it papelón. It's a Venezuelan name.
Que es papelón.
Yes, que es papelón. I've seen it here marketed as panela also.
Oh, the sugar.
Yeah, it's the raw, very raw, like minimally processed block of dark brown sugar. And one of my favorite ways is you grate it. You know, when it's fresh, it's kind of soft and it kind of grates nicely. You sprinkle it on your, you know, the ripe plantain, and you roast it in the oven. And it sort of like kind of melts on there and bubbles, and it's just great. And I have a variation in there where I put a nutty topping, like a topping made out of like ground walnuts and lime juice.
That sounds good.
And it's really awesome. I gotta say, now I'm getting hungry thinking about that one in particular.
Well, we're having kind of a resurgence of bananas at home, and so I think the plantains will fit into... I mean, not that we've ever not had bananas, but I bought a whole bunch of them recently to make a roasted banana cream as a waffle topping, because we went to a waffle party last week. Vegan waffle party. And so I roasted the bananas, and it's amazing when you roast them how good they are.
Yeah.
And so I imagine the plantains are probably even better.
Yeah.
And then mixing them with some silken tofu and a little vanilla, they made a really wonderful creamy topping.
Yummy.
Okay. Next, spicy food phobic. Now, this is a good one because in my family, we have a few expressions that my dad always says, and one of them is no spicy. And he's kind of stayed away from the Mexican restaurants. In general, but we finally got him to go to one a few years ago, and he found plenty of things to eat. But the thing is, some people don't like the heat. Now, I do.
Okay, yeah.
But there's a lot of herbs and spices that have a lot of flavor that don't have the heat.
Mm-hmm.
So there's something for everybody.
Yeah, and not all Latin American food is spicy. I think that's one thing people tend to, like, you know, they have this preconceived notion that everything has tons of chili peppers, but a lot of South American food isn't spicy at all. Caribbean food could go either way. So, you know, there's a lot of, there's room for everyone. Spicy food enthusiasts. Some things I've had to make spicy that traditionally aren't even that spicy, because I feel that Americans, you know, are getting, their palates are kind of warming up to a lot of hotter food now.
Warming up. No pun intended.
None at all.
You write, experience has taught me and countless others that the way to a complaining familia is through their stomachs. And I've said that so many times, maybe not quite that way, but just giving people delicious food and putting it in their mouths all of a sudden gets them interested, gets them happy, and that's the best way to convince people about the food that you love. Put it in their mouth and get it to their stomach. But how did your family handle your transition?
Oh, terribly. I was 16 when I first made the step to being vegetarian, and this was like the 80s, and you know, the suburbs. Like, there really was nothing like there is today with the internet and so many great restaurants. It really was a very different time. You know, and I feel that today, especially young people have it so easy. But yeah, you know, and part of what I did was I was cooking already before that, and I just started cooking even more. And, you know, I always was just very proactive in the kitchen, and I encourage that to anyone who, you know, let's say you have you're living with other people, I'm guessing, you know, who may be skeptical of what you're trying to do. You gotta take some responsibility there, and, you know, learn how to use a kitchen, ultimately, you know?
Well, you bring up a good point, because it's easy if you feel at home in the kitchen, but so many people today are lost in the kitchen, really lost. We've unlearned centuries of skills that were in the kitchen, and it's part of my mission to get people back in the kitchen and love it.
Absolutely.
It's just so
important. Yep.
And you know, when you have a gathering or a holiday or a party, people just naturally like to collect in the kitchen. There's something special about it, because I think we're meant to be making our food. Okay. So you had some trouble, but somehow they've accepted you.
Oh, yeah. They have no choice at this point. I bent them to my will. And like I said, cooking all the time, you know, and my parents are very receptive too. Like, you know, I would constantly be calling them and asking them questions. And,
well, I got the impression from your book and that food is an important part of your upbringing and your culture. And you can see that in the dishes that you've made. So I can imagine, you know, what a lot of people have when they're transitioning is the societal part of it. That's the hardest thing, dealing with their partner, their spouse, their parents, their friends, and people can make it really difficult.
Yes, as if it couldn't be hard enough. But or they can be great. You know, it can go either way. That's one surprising thing you find out.
Okay, moving right along in this wonderful book. I like when you mention what you use to flavor some of your foods, like using different vinegars for soups or seasonings, and beer.
Yes. I am a big fan of cooking.
I love cooking with beer and
alcohol. And beer, but particularly, I think, that's a word, adds a lot of a depth and a lot of richness, you know, when you're especially, because a lot of these dishes are sort of lower fat too, just naturally. So I feel like things like beer picks up, you know, background flavors, and it is really enhanced by hot food especially.
I try not to cook with oil in general, just at home, regular. Okay. I try and stay away from oil and sugar and salt, except when it's, you know, some celebratory feasty thing.
Sure.
And so I do. I like to sometimes cook with teas, and wine and beer. Mm-hmm. But beer is a winner.
Yeah,
very complex,
absolutely,
rich, deep, great flavor. So, you know, if you're partying and you have some leftover beer, keep it.
Yes, absolutely. It doesn't even have to be fancy beer.
No. Now, you mentioned you talk about the non-dairy milks, and it's so exciting because there's so many of them today.
I know.
And like you said before, it's so easy. It's so much easier now than it was a decade, 2 decades, 3 decades ago. And there's soy milk, rice milk, almond milk, oat milk, hazelnut milk, hemp milk, and they all have different qualities. And you mentioned some of that, which is a good thing, because some people get a little confused about, you know, which one should I have and what is it for. So that's really helpful, your recommendations there. You mentioned some cream substitutes, and there's something here called Mimic Cream. I'm not familiar with
that. No, I haven't seen it a whole lot. I've seen it actually on some health food stores on the west side, like a little lower. And it's really wonderful. It's a cream substitute made from cashews and almonds, and it's very decadent and very rich. And they don't pay me to say this. I really love it, and I wish I could find it more. And there's also now there's also one made out of coconut too. Different company that does like a coconut based creamer that doesn't taste coconutty necessarily, but has the richness and the texture that's really
nice. That's nice. was at this same vegan waffle party last week where somebody had a whipped cream that was vegan, but it had a lot of things in it that weren't really healthy. High fructose corn syrup, hydrogenated oils. I mean, these are curse words in my vocabulary.
Yeah, right, yeah.
So, you know, I like to go with the coconut creams and the nut-based creams.
Yes.
The whole foods.
Yeah, I made chocolate truffles the other night using a coconut creamer that was quite yummy. But yeah, there's so much good stuff out there right now.
Okay. Now, I'm a real big fan of beans.
Great.
Just beans in general. They're really inexpensive. What I like to do is I buy them in bulk. I keep them in glass jars. They don't have to be refrigerated. Mm-hmm. They last forever. They're superfoods. And then when you're inspired, you can soak them overnight and cook them. And they're ready to go. And then you can freeze some of them if you want to. And they're just wonderful. And what more can I say about them? They're just like a perfect mix of protein and starch, mm-hmm. and very satisfying. Okay, endless. There's a lot of wonderful recipes here. But one thing I've been talking about, and I see them in here, is that there are more beans out there that I didn't know about.
There's a whole world of beans.
And, you know, in the United States, and unfortunately more and more in other countries, agribusiness is really narrowing our food choices with monocrops. And because it's easier to grow one thing in acres and acres and acres and acres, it's not good for the environment. It's not healthy for that particular crop because it becomes more vulnerable to viruses and pests. And it's not good for us because variety is the spice of life. And so I love to read about other things that I haven't tried. And maybe you could talk about some of these because I'm not that familiar with them. So there's the cargamento roman or cranberry bean.
Yeah, it's a bean that's popular in the Caribbean and in the Colombian food, and it has like a earthy taste. It has like a very like rich earthy taste. A little bit like
earthy.
Like a pinto.
Does it taste like dirt?
No, I know, right? You can't say earthy without people like starting to break a sweat. No, it's like very it's a mild bean with like kind of like a very like a hearty flavor to it, you know, and it's like a and it cooks up like very saucy. Like I found it's one of these beans that kind of makes like a nice sauce on its own when you cook it. But one of my favorites I talk about in there is the roja bola bean, which you see in Colombian food. That's unbelievable. It's a beautiful bean when you buy it dry. It's like a perfectly shiny dark red ball with a little white speck on it. Adorable. Mm. And you cook them up and they plump up to maybe almost like half an inch, like they're pretty big.
Wow.
And they have a great, rich, complex, almost peanut-like flavor to them. You know, they're delicious. Wonderful bean.
Where can I get them?
I know, right? I've seen them. Like, I know. I'm going to... It's all about Jackson Heights for me. But in a lot of Queens, when I go to a lot of ethnic markets...
I live in
markets,
Queens.
Oh, there you go.
There you go.
There
Jackson
you go.
Heights.
You got to hit trade fair.
Okay.
They have all their Goya... You know, we're all probably used to seeing Goya beans at one point or another.
And you mentioned they're going organic, too. They're offering
some
organic.
I've seen a couple. Yeah. They're
very
slowly
exciting.
Migrating over there. But if you go to, like, one that, like, supplies, like, a grocery store that supplies an ethnic neighborhood, which I feel like in New York we have it pretty lucky, you go in there and you'll see they'll have like a whole wall of beans, some of these grocery stores.
I love
all
that.
These different kinds that are very exciting. Yeah.
Okay, well, I just want to give a plug for Queens right now,
which
happens to be a borough in New York City. And my understanding is if it's still not, it may not be the top number one, but it is one of the counties in the United States where more languages are spoken than anywhere else. And when you go to Jackson Heights, one thing I love about Queens is you feel like you can travel the world going from different villages in Queens. So Jackson Heights, it's really festive. There's all kinds of wonderful, interesting shops, a lot of Hispanic influence.
Mm-hmm.
And then not far away, you can jump over to Chinatown in Queens. And so, like, you're seeing the world and all these different wonderful foods and flavors in each community.
Yeah, absolutely.
I love it.
Good stuff.
Okay, so I think this is a good time to take a short break, and we will be right back. Thank you.
You're listening to PRN. Progressive Radio Network.
this is an emergency. No, it isn't. It's an urgency. I'm Danny Schechter, your news dissector on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com with a new show called News Dissector. It's built on the blog that I do every day from MediaChannel.org, dissecting news, analyzing what's happening in the world, offering very cool music and great guests. Thursdays, 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. Be there for the square.
The shaky economy, peak oil, and now an unstable climate. Get the inside story with Alex Smith on Radio EcoShock. Top scientists find a looming catastrophe while activists try for change. Experts, authors, and alternative media from around the world and around the corner. Hear it all. Radio EcoShock every Saturday afternoon at 2 o'clock. Listen free and live free right here on PRN, ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com.
Stephen Lindman hosts the Progressive Radio News Hour, Saturdays and Sundays, as well as currently on Thursdays, as an antidote to government and corporate propaganda on the most cutting-edge world and national topics. Distinguished guests are regularly featured to provide commentary and analysis impossible to the dominant media, offering biased, irresponsible misinformation and what Project Censored calls junk food news. The Progressive Radio News Hour airs Thursdays from 11 to 11:30 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, as well as Saturdays and Sundays at 1 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on the Progressive Radio Network. Make it a regular habit and stay informed.
This is PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
Hi, I'm Karen Hartglass, and you're listening to It's All About Food. And we're having a very yummy program today, so I hope you're enjoying it. And if you have any comments and questions, you can call in at 1-888-874-4888. And I also take email comments and questions now, or if you're listening to the archive, you can send me a message at info@realmeals.org. info@realmeals.org. So we were just talking about beans. Are there any more beans that you want to give a little press to while we're
all
on
right.
the subject?
I'm like a bean.
Or we could move on.
A bean publicist now. I'm trying to remember some of the ones that I always love black
beans. Okay, I'm going to tell you. One of my favorite beans is fava beans.
I love fava beans. I talk about them a little bit
A little bit.
And I'm a big fan of green ones. Like when you get them, you can get them frozen. And they're yummy.
When you were describing another bean with an earthy flavor, I always say that fava beans have a musty flavor.
All the great sellers, right? Yeah.
But there's something really, I want to say, addicting, or just there's just an incredible flavor in fava beans.
Yeah.
So.
There's also a nice bean, the canary bean, a Peruvian canary bean.
Is it yellow?
It is. It's adorable. It looks like a yellow pinto, and it has a mild sweet flavor to it.
Okay, here's a question. I recently tried some split peas that the split peas that I'm used to really get mushy, but this was a split pea that just kind of wouldn't let go. It just stayed chewy. Are any of these beans particularly fibrous and chewy and don't get mushy?
No, I they're all really pretty soft.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of like most Latin American food, I think, is like has a lot of beans are usually cooked really well.
Mm-hmm.
I actually tell people don't undercook your beans.
You know, this split pea, we didn't undercook it.
It's
we
just something
soaked
weird,
it,
something
soaked
happened
it,
with
soaked it, and then cooked it, and every time we made it, it was like that. It was just this bean that wouldn't
rebellious bean
wouldn't give rebellious. Bean. And I imagine some people might like, you know, a chewier thing, but I like when they melt.
Me too.
Okay, let's move on to chiles. So, you have a nice discussion here about the different kinds of chiles. One of my favorite is chipotle.
Oh, yes.
Because it doesn't have to be hot.
Not always, no. It can be, I mean, technically a chipotle can be any kind of pepper in Mexico. Mm. Like, it's kind of like the treatment of where they take it and they kind of, it's roasted and smoked. So from my understanding, it's often, usually it's jalapenos, the ones, most of the ones that we see. But they can, it can really be any kind of.
Because I have some that are smoked and in a powder, a smoked chipotle powder.
Okay.
Really, really great flavor.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. One of my favorites is chipotles in adobo sauce, which is a Mexican product, which is like chipotles kind of stewed in like a tomato-y kind of sauce.
Mm-hmm.
Very intense, and it's delicious. Just adding it to anything, really. Adding a tomato sauce to rice or something makes a really big difference. Good
and,
stuff.
And this is what's amazing, what I would love people to learn, people that think this kind of food is really boring, because it's very easy. And very easy to make lots of different things. For example, we made a big pile of black beans.
Mm-hmm.
And every day we ate black beans for like 2 or 3 days. And they were always different.
Oh, yeah.
And when there was a little bit left over, I made soup. And I just like poured in tons of these different, some kind of orange mix and some red mix, these different spicy powders. Mm-hmm. And some onion. And
yeah.
Used the, what do you call it, the immersion blender.
Okay, yeah.
Word it all up, and it was just great.
Yeah, I mean, you could, in theory, make a pot of beans on Sunday night, and you could just have something different every day for, like, the next, like, 3 or 4 days or more.
Now, here's another note for some of you that aren't fond of beans because you say they give you gas. You know, there's that little rhyme, and I am not going to go there.
We all know it.
But I've been told that if you eat beans on a regular basis, your body gets used to them and you don't have the gas or as much.
I think that's true. I find, I mean, they, I don't want to talk about my own bean habits necessarily, but like, I definitely I don't find those issues that a lot of people say that don't really eat a lot of beans. And they don't, I mean, beans usually fill me up, but I find a lot of times when people are unaccustomed to eating them, they eat a little bit and they get really,
really
full.
Bloated. Yeah.
And they kind of are like, oh, I don't know what to do again. So, I mean, I don't remember really ever using Beano. And I like,
no, Beano's really not even a vegan product.
Really?
It has gelatin in it.
Really?
Yeah.
Beano exposed.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I would say just like there are ways to, I talk about in there to sort of minimize
right
in the cooking during the cooking process, which I think probably people are fairly familiar with if you've been, you know,
soaking and rinsing and
right. Yeah. And there's the Mexican option of adding epazote.
Oh, let's talk about epazote.
Yeah, it's kind of neat. Oh, did I don't hear myself now.
Oh, you're unplugged.
Okay.
Hold on a minute.
Okay.
Right here.
Oh, no. I'll keep talking. So epazote is a Mexican herb. It's from what I understand, it's usually called Mexican oregano, but it's not. It's not actually. It's related to the lemon verbena family, and it has an interesting flavor to it, like a kind of minty, thymy kind of flavor. And added to beans, it's supposed to reduce the gas.
Mm.
And they're cooked with a little, like a dash of it or so. I also sometimes use kombu as well, which is like an old school.
Okay, now you're mixing all kinds. This
I know.
Is America.
Okay. I know. Here I am. This is what I do. I mix it all up.
Kombu is a seaweed.
Yeah.
That is very nice in Japanese broths and and macrobiotic food.
Yeah.
But, you know, you could stick it in any boiled water concoction.
Yeah, and it, some say it helps them with gas as well.
Mm-hmm.
It helps break down the sugars
right.
that create
But
that.
I think the best thing is to just bear with them and have them regularly, and you will get used to them, I promise. And the bonus, it's really worth it.
Yes.
It's a great food, and it's a great food that's satisfying, and if you want to lose weight, beans are really a good way to go.
Yay, beans.
Yay, beans. And yay, chiles. Okay. Now let's talk about ahi.
Oh, yeah.
So do you have any recipes for ahi in this book?
Well, I mean, ahi is, it's ahi.
Ahi, I'm sorry.
Ahi is just another way of saying chilies, you know.
Right, but this
and
is
also
the mixes or the... They're different kinds. Don't they come in, like, pastes?
Yes.
That's what I'm thinking of,
okay.
These pastes.
Okay, ají is usually, like, sort of the South American term for chile.
Mm-hmm. You know, and the ones I talk about in the book are used in Peru and Bolivia and, like, you know, areas around there where there's a couple really great chili peppers down there that I think could make a really big splash up here. You know, there's a...
Well, there might be a line of branded foods for you.
Right, I know. Ají paste. There you go, everyone. There's ají amarillo, which is kind of like a yellow pepper that's less spicy than a jalapeno. I think it has a nice fruity bouquet to it. It's very yellow. It makes your food yellow when you put it in there. There's ají panca, which is really one of my favorites and mm-hmm. was a big hit with a lot of the testers. It's very mild. It's milder than I'm trying to think of the pepper it reminds me of mostly, like an arbol, like a chili de arbol, like very kind of like it has a dark woodsy, smoky red flavor, but not spicy. It's sweet. It's mm-hmm. actually it has almost fruity notes to it. Really good. Really wonderful. Another one of my favorites. And then there's the ricotta ají, which is really, really hot. That's like the other end. It's like a hot tropical tasting pepper. Very good stuff.
Well, I guess some of the things that I'm concerned about is there's a few different hot pepper sauces and pastes that have made their way into most stores. Mm. And a lot of them have sodium benzoate.
Oh, yes.
And some other, you know, nasty preservatives. Mm. And so, you know, I look, you know, how can I make them myself? Or are there brands that don't have those things in them?
It's hard to say because, like, this is an imported product from, mm-hmm. you know, from Peru usually or Bolivia. So if you really want, sometimes you can find them frozen. Hmm. In some ethnic grocery stores, or if you have a garden, grow them. Hmm. I think I wish I had a garden. I'm one of those New Yorkers. I don't even have a terrace.
I do.
So if you know, if you are,
I'm going to grow them.
Yeah,
that's a good idea.
If you have a green thumb and are a little motivated, I mean, I think peppers are pretty easy to mm-hmm. grow. So try it out.
I have a lot of pages tagged in this book, and I know that we're barely getting through the introduction, but that's okay. I want to talk a little bit about corn husks.
Okay.
And what I love about the whole concept of using corn husks is it's a very environmentally friendly thing.
Sure. Yeah, right?
Yeah. So, you know, here we are in the United States. We wrap everything with plastic and then put it in plastic and mm-hmm. then put it in a paper bag. And I'm always talking about the foods that are portable, that you can throw in your backpack, not some disposable packaging like bananas and apples and pears and papaya and mm-hmm. all kinds of things. And then, you know, a sandwich or some kind of portable food that you can use a corn husk.
I know. I do. I love that, too. There is something exciting and satisfying about that.
So are they mostly used just for tamales?
Yeah, pretty much. There's like, it's a whole, like, and a tamale necessarily doesn't have to be wrapped in a corn husk. There's actually ones wrapped in banana leaves.
There's another one, banana leaves.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
We need to bring those things back.
Yeah, let's bring back the banana leaf. I'm working on it. You know, next round of recipes, I will try to get those in. There was a lot to do, but the corn husk. Yeah.
Right. So the technology behind a tamale and a corn husk is you make some sort of paste and spread it.
Yeah. Yeah. You make a corn dough. The most simple, there are tamales that are as simple as just nothing but corn dough kind of steamed in a wrapper, but they're really good when you start putting fillings inside the dough
mm-hmm.
or mixing them into the dough, and that's where the magic happens.
Back to what I was talking about before about how where the diversity is really limited in terms of the different kinds of varieties of food. Corn is one of them, where there's lots of different kinds of corn, and then the way they're prepared. So there's polenta, which a lot of us are very familiar with now. You can pretty much find that in any mm-hmm. market. But then you talk about masa harina and masa arepa.
Yeah, yeah.
And they all have very unique flavors, and they do very different things.
Yeah, yeah. Those are two. In Latin America, corn is consumed differently you know, and it's such a basis of like what people eat every day, well, sometimes three times a day with their meal as a bread, you know, and with the examples that we probably know best are corn tortillas. I think everyone's seen a corn tortilla now, but there are other ways they're consumed as well, you know, throughout that. And usually it is a kind of a flour that's sort of made, that's a pre-cooked flour. It's a sort of a different kind of concept where, you know, with masarina and masarepa, where the corn is pre-cooked. So what happens is all you have to do is you add water to it, and it kind of coalesces into a dough. Kind of that reminds me of sometimes a Play-Doh that you can mold and shape and stuff and fill and pat into, you know, rounds to grill, or you can do a lot with it. And that's a very, very common way that corn is consumed.
But they have very different flavors.
Yes, they do. They do, definitely. The masarina, the Mexican style one, is used. It's lime water. The corn kernels are treated with what's the golden word? Nixtamalization.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Yeah, or and it has a very distinct flavor to me. Mm-hmm. Like the lime with the corn.
I love it. I love what it does to
me
it.
Me too. You know, and if you ever get a chance to get fresh masarina, that's a real treat. You know, that's not hard to find, but you know, if you can find it, like, you know, it's really great. But the one that they consume in Venezuela and Colombia is not treated with that, so that has like a milder flavor to it. So and it works a little bit differently, but basically it's also used in the same way.
Okay, so one thing that drives me crazy, and you've probably noticed it, is we have more and more tortilla options in the regular supermarkets now, and corn tortillas should be made from corn, maybe a little salt, maybe a little water, but that's it. And if you read some of the ingredients today on the supermarket tortillas, there's like 50 ingredients, literally, and most of them you don't understand, and then they put cellulose in them. It's really horrible.
Yuck.
And there's absolutely no reason to do this.
No, not at all.
It's like, where can we hide all this garbage we're collecting from I don't know where else?
Cellulose?
It's criminal. Cellulose.
Newspaper?
Yeah, I mean, what did they really mean by cellulose?
That's absurd. I there's no need to do that, and I'm sure, like, you know, no tortillas in Mexico have cellulose in them, you know? And I talk about making your own in there. You know, you could do it with, like, regular masarina that you can get almost, you know, in any kind of ethnic market, and it's so satisfying. It's so fun to make.
I haven't made a corn tortilla in a long time, but back I think it was in the 80s when I was living in California, and I was newly employed out of college and buying every little gadget or whatever, I saw a tortilla press and bought one, and then the instructions said you had to have masa harina, and I had no idea what it was, and I had to find it, and that was really challenging, and I made tortillas, and that was really fun. And then in the 90s, I lived in France for 4 years, and you could not find a tortilla anywhere.
Sure.
And so I would want to make burritos.
Right.
And I would make my own flour dough and roll them out without a press and make my own burritos.
Yeah.
And sometimes when I would visit United States, I would buy some big packages and stuff them in my suitcase and bring them to France, just because, you know, there are just some things you need.
Sure.
But I think they've even made it to France now.
Oh, wow. Okay. I don't know if I'd go to France for a tortilla. But hey, I'm glad they're enjoying them. You know,
like, but when you're at home and you're making food, sometimes you have to have a burrito.
Sure, absolutely. You know, and you can make flour tortillas there, too, as well. I also talk about making flour tortillas, which are great for burritos.
Okay, I'm looking at my notes here. We've talked about that. Okay, one thing I like is you talk about the equipment and tools that you use in the kitchen, and they're very basic, the things that you use, and you even mentioned that you don't own a stand mixer.
No.
You know, and I don't either. There's no room for one of those.
No. Who in New York has room for that? I'm just saying. I feel like it's one of those things people expect you to have. I'm like,
yeah, I know. My partner Gary always wants to have one. And okay, maybe one day. But cast iron.
Yes, I'm a huge
fan. Can we, like, pray to cast iron or something?
We can have a cast iron, you know, love fest right now. I can't get enough of cast iron cookware. It's so good.
It's so good.
And it's just great for everything. And it will really last you forever with minimal effort, I feel, you know?
I went through my Teflon phase.
Absolutely.
And And now I don't want to use Teflon. You know, it's got a pretty bad rap. And cast iron does the trick. You can make pancakes and mm-hmm. a variety of delicate types of food. Mm-hmm. You can grill. You can do everything in cast iron.
Yep. I have a cast iron crepe pan I use. Mm-hmm. I have many different sizes of big, huge cast iron kettles for making everything from like beans to bread or whatever. I also talk about using a stainless steel. Like, you might want to get one big mm-hmm. stainless steel.
I use stainless steel too.
You know, but I pretty much phased out all my Teflon.
Mm-hmm.
You
boo.
Know,
with Teflon, boo.
Right. I think I maybe have a muffin tin or something. You know,
yeah.
something.
My waffle iron has Teflon in it.
It's tough, but you know, once you can be done, people. You can get rid of the crappy Teflon pan. Like,
and then you talk about deglazing your Teflon. I mean, sorry, deglazing your cast iron.
Yeah, yeah.
Can you talk about deglazing?
Deglazing the cast iron. You mean like kind of like finishing?
I think you said you use wine or something Okay, well, deglazing is something that I think a lot of people don't know about and
okay.
should.
Okay, I usually don't deglaze in a cast iron. That's mm-hmm. the one thing I do use for stainless steel. But deglazing is fantastic. It's a basic chef thing.
Right.
And I say you could throw that term around to your friends and, you know... You could be like, I'm a fancy chef. But it's when you've sautéed something, and there's, like, bits of, like, maybe sautéed manner and oil, like, sticking to the bottom of your pan, that don't wash the pan just yet. You know, what you want to do is you want to put something like a liquid, like beer or wine or vegetable broth if you don't do alcohol, or even water sometimes. And you essentially let it boil and kind of dissolve those little bits of like of food and oils, and it creates like a delicious flavor. It pulls the flavor out of there. There's a mm-hmm. lot of flavor in there mm-hmm. that really should be used in anything from like a sautéed greens to a sauce or anything. It's a great technique to use, and it's so easy. It doesn't really
well. It's a great technique because not only do you get a very flavorful sauce, but it's a great way to clean your pot.
I know,
because most people will see all that gooey, gooey, crunchy stuff and mm-hmm. put it in the sink, and then it's like impossible. To scrape it off.
Yeah.
So it's really a magical
Everybody
technique.
Wins.
Everybody wins. Deglazing. Okay, we don't have much time left.
Oh, okay.
But there are so many wonderful recipes in here. So we might hit a few more of these, but I'm talking about Viva Vegan, which I also like to say Viva Vegan.
Mm-hmm.
And this is by Terry Hope Romero, and you have a website.
Yes.
Vegan Latina.
Yes.
VeganLatina.com. Mm-hmm. Also, you, along with Isa Chandra Moskowitz, you co-authored some cookbooks with her.
Sure, yeah.
And you created the Post-Punk Kitchen.
Oh, that was quite a while ago. That was kind of our first venture.
Mm-hmm.
That was a public access show on BCAT in, is it the 90s now?
It's wow.
or maybe the early aughts. And it was a lot of fun. It was us cooking, just making a couple of recipes in her kitchen with all kinds of all kinds of retro goodies and stuff on the kitchen on the wall, all vegan, and we'd have a band come on halfway mm-hmm. through, and they'd chop up sweet potatoes or headbang in the living room or we did have a tamale episode. I made tamales in one, and we had a George Bush head pinata. I don't know. I can tell you that's how long ago
right.
this was. Yeah, but
that could still be fun.
Right? Yeah, it was a good time. You know, it was a lot of work.
And the website for that is
The PPK. It's got a lot of recipes on there,
right.
A huge message board. It's a pretty active, very active vegan community, I would say, on the internet.
Great. Well, definitely check that one out. Now, before we go, I want to talk about a few unusual foods that most people don't know about. We've talked about some of them, but there are some of the starchy root vegetables,
yes.
like nami.
Yame and yuca
and
is my
yuca.
Favorite. Yeah, yuca is another big one that if you're looking for something inexpensive and satisfying, I see in New York supermarkets, it's ridiculously cheap.
Mm-hmm. And what do you do with them?
Oh, you can treat it like a potato. You always have
to peel them.
You got to peel it. Usually, usually waxed has like a very thick woody.
Yeah, right.
So you got to get through that peel, and boiling is almost always the first step. You just need to boil it soft. You can eat it like that, soft, as a kind of a very creamy, nutty flavor. You could fry it for a very decadent treat. Mm-hmm. Very like, oh, I'm getting away with something kind of treat. It's often mashed and used in other things as well. Soups, it's great in a soup as well. Big chunks of yucca.
Oh, you know, you have some beautiful pictures in the middle of this book, and there was one soup.
Oh, yes. I love that. The sancocho.
Yeah. What's in that soup? It looks so good.
Everything is in that soup. Sancocho is just basically a big, huge soup. And usually it has a lot of root vegetables. It's a place where you can, you know, I put yucca in there. And I put plantains in there as well.
Right.
And but if you go to, like, any kind of ethnic store and you see all these different kinds of tropical root vegetables, you can, you know, buy one here, buy one there, and put it in the soup and try it out. See how
I like soups that have broths.
Yes, it's a very brothy soup.
And it looks like a very good... Do you know what that's made of, the broth?
I remember, believe it or not, the yucca and the root vegetables help thicken it.
Mm.
They cook it down, but there's also fresh thyme in there. There's tomatoes.
Shallots.
There's a little shallot.
Leek.
Yeah. It's
okay.
It's one of those sweet, mild, berry, vegetable-y broths that,
right.
You know, I think I even put favas in there sometimes.
Throw in a few favas.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's what it says here. Very good. And then... we just have a few minutes left. I want to talk about chorizo.
Okay,
is
sure.
that popular in Venezuela, or is that a Mexican?
All over Latin America, they eat some form of that. But, you know, and I was like, well, there's seitan recipes in the book, and
mm-hmm.
I wanted to make a vegan chorizo to work with that as well. And, yeah, I mean, it's eaten all over the place, and it kind of varies from country to country how they season it up, and I give people options for that as well. And that one is a baked one. A baked chorizo that
mm-hmm.
you kind of roll it up in foil. You make these seitan
mm-hmm.
like logs, sort of so
very
to speak.
Fun,
very mushy. This mushy dough, and then you, after you bake it in sort of a sausage shape, it comes out as a sausage. You've made sausage, you know,
right.
Crazy vegan sausage that you can now do whatever you want with. And I use it in soups in there, and tacos, and quite a few other things. It's really kind of an all-purpose thing. You can just make a bunch of chop up. You can
mm-hmm.
kind of throw it in your food and whatever you.
It's amazing. There are some chorizos on the market that you can buy pre-made, but
yes.
What's crazy about it? Not crazy, but. What flavors this thing is all of the spices. And
mm-hmm.
so it doesn't matter what you use. It can be meat or it can be plant-based. But
right.
you can make it taste
absolutely
the same and be good.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I throw a lot of spices in this one. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It's a good one. I like it.
I was doing a show once in California, and some of the guys in the chorus were Mexican, and I would have them all over for some parties, and I made this vegan chorizo once, and
oh, wow.
I got the greatest compliment. This one guy said that he thought his grandmother would really like it.
Aww, that's always when you get the grandma comment, you're doing something right.
Okay, well, I think we've got about a minute left.
1 minute.
And how about a sweet note? Do you have a favorite dessert?
Oh, boy, favorite dessert. Maybe easier desserts, the papaya lime sorbet.
Oh,
is
that
really
sounds good.
Good. Tres leches cake. That is something that is a little bit of a project, but it's really great, and I've had many great positive responses. People really like it. It's just like a creamy, coconutty cake.
Mm-hmm. Yum.
Yeah, everyone loves coconut, so, you know. and churros. Churros.
Okay. I'm definitely going to try them all.
Great.
Thank you so much for coming on the show. Thank you for your creativity. We need this book.
Yay.
So check it out. Viva Vegan.
Viva Vegan.
And you will have some many delicious adventures if you follow the pages of this book. Thanks for listening. This has been It's All About Food. Join me next week where I will be having John Robbins on the show. He has a new book out, and we'll be hearing from him. Of course, check out all the shows on the archive, and have a great week.